Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the BRC's Trade Policy Podcast. I'm William Madison. In the news this week, are we heading for a deadlock in the EU-UK negotiations with only weeks remaining? How has Golfgate caused political upheavals within the European Commission? And how does the UK internal market look with 4 months left to go in the transition period? I'm joined as ever by the BRC's trade policy expert, William Bain. William, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
And our protocol expert, NIRC Director Aidan Connolly. Aidan, how are you?
Hello there.
So, William, starting with you, every edition of the podcast at the moment seems a little bit like Groundhog Day when we're talking about negotiations. Have they really gone anywhere over the last 5 months? Michel Barnier said last week that in some areas they've gone backwards, actually. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's a real concern. I mean, from the minute the transition period was time limited and was not going to be extended, we were headed towards this kind of political crisis. I mean, the key thing is we know what the positions of both sides are. You know, each is looking for some movement from the other. On things like state aid, the sort of government subsidies for businesses, and on fisheries. And, you know, getting a suitable agreement on those is a red line for the EU to have a tariff-free deal. And what's happened over the last few weeks is we've had a kind of paring down of the offer from the UK. So the EU felt in some respects that the UK was still looking for some of the benefits of being in the single market whilst being outside the single market and having regulatory autonomy. And it is true that many of the sort of market access provisions in the UK government's offer were based on precedents, but it was just all sorts of different precedents and not simply a cut and paste from the Canada-EU trade agreement. And many of those additional things would have been of real help, you know, whether that was going to be a veterinary agreement, which the BRC has called for very strongly, agreement on organics, an agreement on wines, you know, other information sharing issues around pharmaceuticals and chemicals. And, you know, on a lot of these areas, as time is acting against everyone, the UK has departed from its original offer and has dropped many of these additional asks. But the issue is that that isn't really getting us anywhere with the matters that still have to be resolved. So, for example, last week, David Frost, the UK's chief negotiator, presented to Michel Barnier at the discussions in Brussels what was described as a consolidated text. And this was the UK government's view of the sort of agreed legal text on matters of convergence between the two sides. Now, Michel Barnier is said to have responded quite badly to this and said, well, you know, it is for both sides to work out where the areas of convergence are, not just one. And therefore, you know, we cannot use this consolidated text as a basis for negotiating individual chapters of this agreement. And so what that throws into sharp focus is that, you know, really with around 2 months at maximum left in these negotiations, we have no agreed text on any area. You know, we have nothing which sort of can provide certainty to businesses, to citizens at this stage. But there is this sort of nagging sense that more and more of the things that might have made the agreement somewhat more palatable and worked more in the interests of business have been discarded. And what we're looking at, if it is possible to reach an agreement, which is still must be a 50-50 question, is a deal which is very thin. It certainly would provide for zero tariffs. There isn't time to negotiate tariffs as part of any EU-UK deal now. But a lot of the trade facilitations measures on the areas I talked about there are in danger now of being lost. And so that means you could have a very thin deal being done at the last minute. And that is a problem, I think, for many sectors and many industries, including retail. Look, overall, this needs political hands on the tiller. We have two rounds scheduled for September. We'll see how far things progress. But if things haven't really progressed by the middle of September, I think people will be looking to the UK government, to the Prime Minister. People will be looking to some of the political leaders in the European Council to try and provide a little tilt to how the negotiations might proceed in this final phase. And we may see some slightly different positions being adopted by Mr. Frost and Monsieur Barnier if that occurs. But there is a gulf still between both sides on state aid. And it seems that the UK government will have to make some kind of move by publishing a policy paper, which perhaps might indicate its preferred approach to state aid in the coming years. That would provide, I think, the European Commission with the confidence to be able to make a move to take out the previous position calling for European Court of Justice involvement and oversight of common state aid rules. But in return, the UK government is going to have to state what it actually wants to do on state aid. And this is, again, quite a tricky area, because historically, the UK has been one of the EU's least likely countries to want to engage in state aid. One thinks of previous Conservative governments for whom state aid would have been anathema. But this one, intent on keeping together its electoral coalition in the Red Wall seats in the Midlands and in the north of England, believes that having flexibility with state aid and support for industry is important and could provide some trading and economic advantage. So this is really, I think, the key issue where the bottleneck is, and we have really just a few weeks to try and resolve it.
So what would be the three main aspects that the retail industry would like to see emerge by the end of October? And further to that, is a weak deal better than no deal at all?
On that latter point, undoubtedly, because at least a weak deal leaves open the possibility for a strengthened deal in the future. And I think given the dynamics that are now at play in this negotiation process, this is not going to be a sort of big bang event which ends with the expiry of the transition period at the end of December. I think we are going to have a process of potentially further negotiations, not on a concluded FTA if that is reached, but perhaps on side deals, which would be of benefit for industry, whether that is going to be on wine, organics, mutual recognition of conformity assessment, these kinds of issues. They're not going to go away. They are going to cause friction at the border. They will cause delays and problems in getting goods to consumers. And so I think it's very likely that if we get a very, very a sort of ultra skinny FTA, that industry groups will be expecting and encouraging both sides to go back and negotiate some side deals, as has happened with other countries before, in terms of improving the trade facilitation measures. It's going to be so important with an economy both in the UK and the EU, which is still riven with the problems caused by the COVID-19 outbreak and everything that's emerged from that. In terms of the three things that really we need to see emerge, I mean, the key element at this point is a zero tariff deal. I mean, if you inject billions of new costs into supply chains, then you cannot expect that that is not going to be passed on to the consumer, and pretty quickly. So a zero tariff deal on both sides is absolutely essential. It was before the COVID-19 outbreak, I'd say doubly so, given where the economy is now. I think the second thing is to have some kind of adjustment period. What's becoming clear by the week is that despite the best efforts that companies are making to prepare enormous amounts of person hours and investment going into making these new trade arrangements work in the areas where we kind of know what's likely to happen by the 1st of January or 1st of July next year, there are going to be some areas where compliance is just not possible. And so we've had a list of UK government easements. Much better it would be if we can have perhaps a package of easements that we know the Commission is perhaps working on at the moment, and to have those rolled up together into a proper adjustment period. Won't be like the transition period where every aspect of commercial or industry life is governed by EU rules for exactly the same period and enforced in exactly the same way. It might be highly sectoral, it might have a whole series of compliance days, but it would be preferable to the uncertainty of having to piece together two pots of unilateral easements, which is where business finds itself at the moment. I think the third element, even if many of the aspects that we would have wanted to have seen in the agreement, such as making checking and marking of electrical and industrial goods a lot easier, may not be in the final text, we need to have a basis to have hope for the future that these issues can be addressed. And so we would want to at least leave the negotiating table somewhere that we could come back to in the not too distant future to strengthen this trading relationship in the future. So those would be the three things that I think we could hope for at this stage out of what's left in the negotiating period.
So this week we've also seen EU Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan resign over Gulfgate. William, what's the process for replacing the commissioner? And is this going to disrupt EU trade policy at what is obviously quite a delicate time in relation to both the United States and China?
Well, yes. I mean, this was unfortunate, but as the story developed over the week, it really became inevitable as more and more aspects to the tale emerged. Phil Hogan was well respected in Brussels and beyond. He'd served as Agriculture Commissioner before taking over the trade brief in January. He'd been seen to have done well in terms of trying to patch things up ahead of the election with the US. We had the proposals last week to reduce tariffs on lobsters. He had also launched the Commission's Strategic Trade Policy Review, which had been sort of well received and was being well engaged with by companies across Europe. To that extent, I think the direction of where the EU is going to go in its trade policy, which is trying to extract more value out of its existing trade agreements. So they've appointed recently a chief trade enforcement officer. Being more muscular in the world in terms of using trade policy to express EU values and EU economic interests. And also revising things like trade remedies, the general system of preferences, and now also this week, rules of origin as well. So that work, I think, will continue irrespective of who has the political role of trade commissioner. But we are in very delicate times. We have a very unpredictable political situation in the US. That is going to be probably made worse in September and October by the Airbus and Boeing rulings, which may lead to some retaliatory action by the EU. So the issue of trade and tariffs between the EU and the US despite last week's announcements, is still very difficult and very fraught indeed, very explosive. So that is something that requires very delicate and skillful political management. And then also we have the situation in terms of our relationship with China. And as we know, China is the source of a great proportion of our non-food imports into the UK and into the EU. And as we see in terms of the US, things are very volatile. There is a first stage trade agreement, but there's still a lot of sort of Sinophobic language we see coming out of parts of Washington. So these two key trade relationships do need very careful and skillful political handling. And that's why I assume they will want a new trade commissioner in place as soon as possible. I should say in the interim, before the new commissioner is appointed by the Irish government in discussion with Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, Valdis Dombrovskis, one of the Commission vice presidents, is going to assume responsibility for the trade portfolio. So with some of these important discussions around trade remedies, rules of origin, GSP, the wider trade policy agenda, he will look after that whilst a new commissioner is appointed. And here we come to one of the other interesting elements. This is potentially not a straight like-for-like appointment, with the Irish government being able to nominate a new Irish trade commissioner. It may well be that President von der Leyen wants to reshuffle her College of Commissioners. So it's not inevitable that Ireland would keep the trade portfolio. If they did want to keep that, they would probably have to nominate someone with quite a strong trade record. And one of the candidates, I mean, Aidan will talk more about this, has such a record. So it will depend. It's not just issues around that. Clearly, there was some criticism that the commission is not sufficiently gender neutral. And so that's another issue. So President von der Leyen's asked the Irish government to nominate a male candidate and a female candidate. So the issue of gender balance on the commission is going to be an important consideration too. Basically, once nominated, the new commissioner would have to be approved by the parliament and undergo confirmation hearings. And if there was a wider reshuffle of the commission by Ursula von der Leyen, then those changes would also require the consent of the European Parliament as well. So given that there is so much on the table, this has been a regrettable and would be an unwelcome bit of political problems which has arisen totally unforeseen. But nevertheless, I don't think it's going to in any way disrupt the key issues around the EU's trade policy over the next few months.
Yeah, so Aidan, turning to you now, how does this whole affair affect politics in the Irish Republic and its influence in terms of the UK-EU negotiations?
Well, as usual, William has left me with nothing to say. there's two sort of elements to this. So the first one is the internal politics of the Republic of Ireland, and this has been a really rocky start for this new coalition government. Remember, this is the first time that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been in a coalition government since the start of the state of Ireland. That would be like the Conservatives and Labour going into a coalition together. So yeah, really quite strange. We have seen an agriculture minister resign on over drink driving allegations. We have seen this Gulfgate, which has taken some big scalps, and the fallout for this continues. But the biggest scalp on the sort of world stage is that, of course, of Phil Hogan. And for Phil, you know, he had his own particular brand, and that brand is of, as we would say here, he brought senior hurling, which means very rough, very ready, very powerful, very quick sort of negotiating skills and that big presence that he has. He's a big man both in stature and in personality. So he's left some big shoes to fill. That's really, going back to what William was saying, that's really important when it comes to the current negotiations. Now, for the FTA with the UK, it's actually less important because there's a separate framework under which those negotiations are happening. But on the wider European and EU, China, as William was talking about, this is a hugely important appointment. He's absolutely right in saying that President von der Leyen will want someone who is technically adept, who is efficient, and who has a proven track record of negotiation, and also understands the machinations of diplomacy as well as the internal machinations of the EU. Now, there's a few candidates. Again, the gender balance thing is particularly important for President von der Leyen. Though I do think that the pressure of needing to fill this in a very quick space of time is going to be the main balancing pin on this. So there's a few candidates. We've seen the name of Enda Kenny, who was Taoiseach of Ireland up until a couple of years ago when Leo Varadkar came in. Personally, I don't know how that would go down. I don't know if that will be the Irish nomination. While being a world leader, of course, he doesn't. He hasn't had the sort of in-depth technical knowledge of the EU. So I would be quite sort of reticent to put any money on him. On the other side, you have Maria McGuinness, who is the current vice president of the European Parliament, with whom we've done quite a bit of work, William, over the years, haven't we?
Indeed.
And Maria obviously knows inside and out. Actually, we remember at home as a TV presenter. Well, there you go. But before her life in politics. Again, because of the gender balance, because of her stature, then there could well be a good chance for her to get in. The question is, though, does Ireland want to lose the vice presidency of the European Parliament as well? Because that would be the trade-off. They would have to put someone forward for another election as far as vice president is concerned there. And the one that I think is more likely than anyone else is David O'Sullivan. So David O'Sullivan was ambassador of the European Union to the United States 2014-2019, chief operating officer at the European External Action Service. He was director general of external relations. But most important for this, between 2005 and 2010, he was director general of DG Trade. And that is someone who then understands not only the civil service machinations, but the political machinations as well, which is going to be hugely important. However, in saying that, we really don't know. Those would be the front runners. There's a lot of other people who are being put into the pot. I think I heard William's name at one stage, since he's an Irish citizen now. But honestly, it's all up in the air. But those are our biggest sort of candidates, the people that might be worth putting money on.
So Aidan, we're also facing a ticking clock in terms of the new intra-UK trading terms, particularly between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. What's the latest on this?
Well, the UK internal market consultation has finished. And if you look at the principles that are behind that, non-discrimination. And the other one is, William?
Non-discrimination and mutual recognition.
There you go. Thank you very much. I like to give him a test once in a while, just to, you know, he may seem like an expert, but I'm really feeding him all this stuff. So those two principles, while they are audible, laudable and admirable, they are at odds with what is contained in the Northern Ireland Protocol. And, you know, it's great as far as non-discrimination and that mutual recognition. So, for example, Northern Ireland beef that is going over to GB under these principles, under these proposals, and we'd still be able to be part of the Red Tractor scheme. We'd still be able to be part of that quality assurance. But coming GB to Northern Ireland, because we are de facto administering the single market regulations and the Union Customs Code, that means that we will not be able to avail of the same standards. If there are divergence, then there won't be able to be that mutual recognition. There will not be able to be that non-discrimination, quite simply because we will not be following the same rules as the rest of the UK. We will be following the rules of the EU. And that is going to be a huge source of friction. And what we're trying to do, as we've always done, is to make sure that the Northern Ireland consumer has choice and affordability. And to do that, we're continuing to ply on with our asks, and one of those being Trusted Trader. We can't actually use Trusted Trader because it means several different things to several different people. So what we should be calling it is a certified and auditable supply chain with a green channel. So what that actually means is that there's a way to tell what's on the lorries, there's a way to tell where it comes from, there's a way to tell that it meets certain standards. And because you have that traceability, there then could be a green channel, which means that we don't have to stop or have those physical checks or burdensome checks at the ports. And bearing in mind that 70% of all the value of things that are crossing the Irish Sea from Great Britain to Northern Ireland are for retailer shelves, and that's going to make a huge amount of difference in keeping the ports flowing freely.
All right, interesting times as ever. I think that's where we'll leave the discussion for today. And that's also a wrap for summer. We'll see everyone in a couple of weeks' time as we launch into what could be a stormy autumn across trade and Brexit issues. But if you want to keep up with all the information, you can visit our Brexit hub at brc.org.uk/Brexit for all the latest. From us, that's bye for now.